With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to This Anthro Life. I'm Adam Gamwell. One of the superpowers of anthropology is the weaving together of one person's story and key moments that have shaped cultural history and industry and even the way that we do business. The qualitative disciplines are so crucial for gaining a holistic understanding of why products and brands mean so much or so little to us, and how and why those meanings change over time. Now, additionally, this isn't just about gathering insights from research, but there's an active role that the social sciences and humanities can play in translating insights from research to change the trajectory of a brand, service, or product to align with changing social meanings and cultural trajectories. Now, we're going to explore the rise of insights and qualitative-based market research in India with one of its pioneers, Dr. Meena Kashyap. And I'm very excited to introduce TAL correspondent Madhuri Karak, who brings us today's episode. Now, Madhuri is based in Mumbai, India, and often works between the US and India. So Madhuri, thanks so much for spearheading today's conversation.
Hi, Adam. It's great to be here, and I'm really excited to share this conversation with This Anthro Life's listeners today. So today's episode explores the singular story of Dr. Meena Kashyap. She's trained as a sociologist, and she pioneered qualitative market research as we know it today in India. She founded Asia's first exclusively qualitative research firm called Quantum Consumer Solutions at a time when the retail space was dominated by data. Quantum's founding in 1990 preceded India's massive liberalization reforms by exactly a year. And these were a series of financial deregulation measures that allowed foreign companies to access Indian markets. Now, why did businesses ascribe specific value to qualitative insights at that time? And what did Quantum offer that has now consolidated the firm into an enterprise spanning seven countries with 200 plus employees? I am joining you from a very humid, muggy morning in Mumbai, India. And Dr. Kashyap just told me she is in forested outskirts of Bangalore, another city in South India, just a little bit south of Mumbai, in fact. Welcome, Dr. Kashyap. We are so excited to have you.
Thank you, Madhuri. And listeners, if you are hearing the cicadas in the back, that's because I just can't get them to shut up, even if I can keep quiet.
Welcome, cicadas. And welcome, Dr. Kashyap. So let's dive right in. Tell us about your pre-Quantum Solutions days. Where did you grow up? And what brought you to sociology?
So, Madhuri, actually, when I think about where I grew up, lots of cities in India, because my father worked for an oil company, Burma Shell, in those days. And so I spent a large part of my early life in cities like Calcutta, Delhi, Mumbai, Chennai. And really early in life, I started traveling and had a peripatetic life, which continued after I became a researcher and a market researcher. But the latter part, when I was finishing my college, was really spent in Delhi. And I did my doctorate from the Delhi School of Economics, where I became a social anthropologist, and I worked on a very interesting topic, which was really on the death rituals of the Hindus in Varanasi. And I worked with this community, which is really the untouchables, who provide the fire for our funerary rites. So that's really a very quick background about myself.
Thank you. I've read an interview about how you used a semiotic approach to decode the branding and package design of India's favorite malt beverage, Horlicks. And this was apparently your first quote-unquote marketing assignment, although you'd had no experience in the sector before. So yeah, I'm so curious, how did that opportunity come about and what was the company's reaction to your analysis when you trotted out semiotic theory to them, or did you not tell them that's what you were deploying? And then maybe just tell us a little bit about what you discovered when you applied semiotics to Horlicks.
The interesting thing is that this was around 1977 or so, 78. And I just had a child, and my husband had moved to Mumbai. And I found that the university where I could have possibly taught anthropology was way too far for a young mother with a small child. So I was looking around for something gainful to do. And I was told that there was an opportunity in a market research company. In those days, the Indian Market Research Bureau, IMRB, was looking for anthropologists because they had just started what they called a qualitative research division. And so I offered my services as a consultant. And the first job I was given was this study on Horlicks. And I had to analyze the data and write a report. When, you know, it was quite interesting to see how strongly bonded the consumer was with this milk food drink. And when I looked, one of the asks was that I should look at the packaging and comment on the various design features of the pack in those days. And what was quite significant was that in that pack at that time, there was a little flag, the British flag. And when I was decoding it, I used each element to talk about the contribution each design element made to what the brand stood for. And I remember mentioning that the lineage and the heritage value of the flag brings a certain degree of credibility to what the product says it can deliver in terms of nutrition and in terms of values, because it's really in a post-colonial India, there is still a tremendous reverence for things that are made and brought to us from our colonial masters, the British. So, of course, that along with all sorts of other things, which were great insights that came up from the fact that I'm an anthropologist. And I've also done a lot of work in the area of food. So, you know, a milk food drink, the way it's decoded by our consumers, it's nourishing, it's soothing. And that really comes from the way milk is seen in our culture. So I provided a lot of those insights. And I do recall that when the report went to them, and this time the client was in the UK, and when they read it, they said, oh, this is one of the best pieces of work we've seen from your company. So immediately I was suddenly very popular, and I was given lots of work to do. And I also discovered that as an anthropologist, I had a lot to contribute in the area of understanding consumer behavior. And bringing the cultural aspects and a deep understanding of why we behave the way we do because of how we've been acculturated, how we've been socialized and conditioned by our own cultures. So that was really the story on Horlicks and how I began my journey as a market researcher.
Thank you. That's fascinating. And while hearing you speak, I was trying to imagine what the Horlicks packaging was when I was growing up. So full disclosure, I'm a Complan girl, not a Horlicks person. But there were Horlicks aficionados in my family. But I can't recall the Union Jack in the packaging. Do you think they just took it off at some point? What happened to that?
Yes, I think it was, you know, I think there were test packs that we were looking at, and it was removed after a certain point. Yes, absolutely so.
So for our American listeners, I know y'all don't really drink malt beverages or hot beverages of any kind, perhaps other than coffee in the morning, but malted drinks are hugely popular in India, and I would say the subcontinent in general. And actually, I've even encountered Milo in West Africa. So in Ghana, Milo is really popular. So this conversation about hot drinks is taking me back. Thank you for that little slice, Dr. Kaushik. So moving right on, I'm, you know, super curious too about the timing of Quantum's founding and the 91 liberalization reforms. So was this pure coincidence, or did you think that there would be a greater demand for insights into India's vast unknown market, one of the diverse, complex retail spaces in the world? Or did you have to continue to work hard to make a case for qualitative research because that was still an unknown quantity and companies didn't always know that they needed it?
So Madhuri, truth be told, the real hard work to actually make a place for qualitative research in India and in the subcontinent and in Southeast Asia began as early as the 1980s, when I know that after I joined IMRB, we spent a lot of time actually convincing clients that this was a legitimate science. And it was a social science which needed all the respect. And it was extremely valuable for all marketeers to actually engage in some form of qualitative research, not to just confirm and validate their own pet theories, but also to really deeply understand where the consumer was coming from, what culture they were located in, how they were conditioned, and therefore, what kind of behavior patterns we could expect from the consumer. So this really began in 1980. And I remember in one of my very early meetings with a client, I remember being introduced as, oh, this lady, she's a wizard when it comes to the consumer. And God knows what mumbo jumbo she does, but there are these great insights that emerge. And I recall feeling extremely annoyed, though the introduction was extremely complimentary. It wasn't about me. It was about a discipline and a science that anybody who had understood it and actually practiced it would come up with the same kind of insights. And to equate a qualitative researcher with a guru or a wizard, which, you know, who pulls out these little tricks from the hat, was actually demeaning the discipline. So in 1990, when I did set up Quantum with my partners, Shileka Agarwal and Meera Vasudevan, the impetus came from actually wanting to see this discipline get its true place in the world of marketing. And we felt that it was not an addendum. It was not something that you did, oh, you know what, I have no money, so let me do a quick and dirty qualitative research. I really can't mount a survey. Or let me just get a quick understanding of what the consumer has to say, and maybe I'll be able to fight my battle in a marketing forum better. Those were the kinds of problems we were dealing with in the 80s. And by the time we set up the company, I think we'd gained quite a formidable reputation in India. And we had already started known for our work in other parts of the world. So in 1990, it was like, you know what, we need to have a qualitative research company that really brings all the disciplines that are required for understanding consumer behavior into play. And when we set up this company, I remember I was interviewed extensively by business magazines and newspapers and all, and everybody said, there has never been a soulless qualitative research company. So how will you survive? And you know, it's 30 years down the line, quantum is a big force to contend with. We have moved from just a space of pure insights into design strategy. And we are not just an Indian company anymore. We are in Sri Lanka. We're in Bangladesh, we're in Singapore, we're in Indonesia, we're in China, and we're also in the UK. So as you can see, it was a very short-sighted view that qualitative research on its own wouldn't have a place in the industry. And today, I believe that this is not an issue that is ever debated in the marketing forums. They realize the value and they appreciate it, and they're deeply dependent on the kind of work inside companies provide. So we were the pioneers, and it was a big task, but I think it went well, and we're the last ones to have the last laugh.
I love the triumphant note with which you ended. So, you know, looking back on these formative years, are there any particular cases or, you know, brand clients who you worked with that really stands out for you that you could share with us? Maybe some, you know, tactics that really took the field by storm and the results are still much vaunted 3 decades down the line that you can recall?
So in 1990, when we set up Quantum, I didn't expect that all our clients would move with us, and they did. So we had Unilever, we had Cadbury's, we had the PepsiCo's, we had the banks, Citibank in particular, we had ITC, we had a number of blue chip clients who were our regulars in our previous company who just moved with us to support us in this journey on giving qualitative research its due. And one of the things that I'll tell you that really made a difference to the kind of work we did was that we were multidisciplinary right from the very start. I always believed as an anthropologist that you could not do qualitative research unless you brought a number of disciplines together. It was anthropology, it was psychology, it was semiotics, it was history, it was behavioral economics, it was even things like linguistics. So our recruitment policy was extremely eclectic. We were looking at diverse talent. Historians were welcome. Actually, today the company is run by a chemist. She was doing a PhD in chemistry and walked into our life, and here we are. So we were multidisciplinary, and it was really that which gave our product such great depth, because you must see the consumer from every facet, whether it's their psychological makeup and their inner motivations, or whether it's their cultural conditioning and the kind of culture that they operate in, or the historical impact of things that have happened in that country that give an impact. Or as late as today, let me tell you that it's really quite interesting. Sometimes when we do work on a brand, we're also looking to see what other influences from which part of the world are actually impinging on consumer behavior, because globalization has had its own impact. So if I look at brands and stories of brands, one of the stories that is really very a favorite of mine is really the brand Fair and Lovely. And in the 70s, when I first started working with the brand team, it was a brand that was really very strongly rooted in the fairness story. And, you know, if you get fair, you get a groom and you get married. It was such a terrible story. And yet, when you spoke to the consumer, what we were really hearing was that other than gender discrimination, color was also a horrible discrimination. And so the consumer was suffering on many counts, being a woman, being dark, being less possibilities in terms of the culture, because women in India are not really educated as much. If you have limited resources, they will go to the son and they would not go to the woman, to the girl child, and so on and so forth. And I really took it upon myself to see whether we could shift this trajectory of the brand from just makes you fair and therefore, hey, I get the prize groom, to a story of empowerment, that women need to be empowered. And sometimes brands can do that for them and encourage them on this journey of becoming something that they are proud to be. So it was moving away from fairness as the main deliverable to a benefit of empowerment, that you have a right to be proud of who you are as a woman. And so if you look at the communication trajectory of the brand in India, we have taken the brand from this absolutely belittling fairness story to a story where the woman talks about how she seeks equality, how she dares to dream, how she thinks that earning is the most important, the first job is the most important thing in her life, that she needs to achieve that. So this is one brand trajectory where I can tell you that I'm extremely proud, because we've deeply contributed to that. The other story is the story of chocolates in India, which is Cadbury's, where chocolates has always been on the periphery of our consumption template, because Indians are sweet lovers and we are deeply into mithai and, you know, other sweetmeats and their regional favorites and so on. And here was a brand which said, you know, Indians have a sweet, they have a craving for sweet, they have a sweet tooth. Why is it that chocolates can't play a bigger role? And we did a huge study on understanding the sweet culture, food culture in India. And from that, we really came up with the huge insight that when you consume a sweet, that it's really about the sweetness of life. All of life revolves around the sweetness of life, and sweets contribute to that. So every occasion in life which has to be commemorated because it is a celebration of life, that's when sweets feature. And that's when the entire communication for Cadbury's chocolates went to Kuch Meetha Ho Jai, which in English means let's have something sweet, let sweetness come into our life, whichever way you want to translate it. So that's another brand which has done extremely well on this. And we are still, as a company, still engaged with a number of variations on where to take the brand further and further when we come to that. This was a study that did, the brand did extremely well. If you look at the penetration of chocolates in India, that grew. If you looked at the barriers that chocolates had, they got broken thanks to this campaign. It had a huge impact. May I just give you one very lovely story? In Varanasi, when we were doing this study, we found, thanks to this campaign, we went to a Muslim weaver's house, and he said, it is sunnat that we eat something sweet in the day, all right? So it is as per the Quran's prescriptions that we must eat something sweet. He said, so sometimes when we wake up in the morning, if we have nothing sweet which we have cooked ourselves, we have a piece of chocolate. So you see how it had penetrated. It had started penetrating into people's, because you had given it a wider meaning system. You had given it much stronger relevance in their life.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Thank you for sharing these stories. And I think it's been really fascinating to see how, you know, now for festival gift hampers, you're as likely to get chocolates as you're, you know, likely to get burfis and kaju katlis. So obviously they're now at par, if not transcended the appeal of traditional sweets in audiences who were perhaps not traditionally partaking them. Just even how brands evolve and find newer ways to embed themselves in people's identity and how they imagine themselves, I suspect, is also just such a great way to understand precisely that evolution of brands you are talking about earlier. And I was going to say, I suppose we have to wait another 10 years to see Fair and Lovely / Fair and Handsome, which is, you know, now the equivalent of the cream for male identifying folks. Do we have to wait another 10 years for them to drop the fair altogether and come up with something new? Or do you think that's unlikely?
But that's already happened. So it's no longer Fair and Lovely. It's Glow and Lovely.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I think I missed that.
And I'll tell you that they're extremely cognizant of the changing sentiment around. And given the fact that they've always been an empowerment brand, they were very quick to see the need to change and to stand for something bigger for the consumer, but not to leave the consumer alone on this journey, but stay with it. Let me also tell you that fairness as a need is worldwide. And we may say what we like about it, but the truth of the matter is it's inherent in every culture. Because I tell you, I've looked at every single culture on this space, and I was shocked that even the fairest of fair, even in the Anglo-Saxon cultures, we see such a strong need for it. So it's deeper than we imagine. Perhaps it's something which is to do with racial hegemony. I don't know. I don't have all the answers. But yes, do we need to pander to it? No, maybe not. But I think we can't ignore the fact that it exists.
Yeah, absolutely. I think light skin privilege and the desire for light skin is very cross-cultural. You have to just walk into a store aisle anywhere and find the culprits enjoying massive popularity. Let's pivot a little bit from creams and chocolates, as fun as it is, to talk about methods. So in the corporate research world, when you say qualitative research, what exactly are you describing? Because I'm assuming no one is spending weeks doing traditional ethnographic fieldwork. So when market researchers are doing qualitative research, what is immersion? What is consent? What does interviewing look like? I think it'd be really interesting for our listeners to hear from you about just methodological concerns.
I would talk about insights research rather than just qualitative, because qualitative is, as a term, is a little limiting, and it takes you to a space which is not fully developed, because we've moved way further than that. We're really, as I told you, we're in the whole space of multidisciplinary approach to understanding consumer behavior. So it takes into account a lot of disciplines. And traditionally, it was always face-to-face. There was, you either use the focus group method, or you use depth interviewing, or you use the participant observation where you immersed in the consumer's life, or you looked at digital information. You did desk research, which gave you the cultural background of where the consumer was located. But since COVID, everything has gone digital. So really what's happened in the last 2 years is it's not as if it wasn't there. It was always there. We were doing it in different forms, but it was just one of the tools that we were using. So digital ethnography and digital interviewing was just one of the tools we were using prior to the COVID. But post-COVID, everything, all ethnography, all interviewing, all insight gathering has become digital. And so we've had to resort to some really interesting ways of collecting data. For instance, if I look at participant observation, it means that the anthropologist needs to participate in the life of the consumer in different facets of that life and collect data over a few points on the timeline, so that you're able to really get a really more comprehensive view of the consumer's life. But what's happening now is that we can't do that. There's no face-to-face interaction with the consumer happening. I cannot go to her home. But I can go to her home digitally. So the methods that we have had to resort to is, one is that there's digital ethnography. We actually get onto either a WhatsApp call or a, you know, Zoom call on the laptop, or it's a mediated space like this where you create a chat room for people to come in and talk. And the other is that we have to augment this with what we call self-ethnography, which is, to give you an example, if I say, I want to understand your skincare habits. So I'll give you a task-oriented self-ethnography to do. So I'll say, could you do a small video of using your phone to just show me how you wash your face and what do you apply on your skin post that, and why do you do that? Speak into it. So it's smaller bites of information that come to you via the digital media. So it could be a video film. It could be pictures that she's a photo journal. It could be a diary which she has written and completed. It could be talking into WhatsApp call. It could be us interviewing them online, understanding the culture of that they are operating in. We also augment this because, you see, when you're doing any kind of ethnography, you're really also trying to look at all the points of influence in the consumer's life. So we would augment this with, say, generational interviews, interviewing the mother, the daughter, trying to see where the influences are coming from. Or we would do family interviews where we would interview the husband, children, and other members of the family to try and see, therefore, how does decision making take place, and how are brands being used, what are the preferences being voiced in the family. We would also, for instance, look at their social media very carefully. So gaining their permission, we would look at their chat rooms, we would look at their WhatsApp chats, we would look at things they post on Facebook, Twitter, TikTok, wherever, whatever, and Instagram. We would look at their photo journals. So there's a host of spaces from where we would get information about the consumer. But in addition to that, we would do what we call a historical trend analysis to understand maybe a category or maybe a culture or maybe just a brand, a specific brand, where we would do media analysis. We would look at all the advertising, or we would look at all the social media chatter on that particular brand or category. We would look at trends across the world to see what's happening. What's happening really is to get one insight or to work on one category or a brand, it's a bit like a spoke in a wheel. So you have a central point, which is your, what do I have to deliver? And then you've got these various spokes, which are, you know, your little arrows that go into various data sources, which you pull out. And then you put them all together to come to a holistic understanding of the real, I'll call it the semiosphere. It's really the semiotic sphere within which every individual is operating. So I'm really looking at various feeds to give me an understanding of the consumer located like this. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and I think that wheel analogy you made is actually really evocative and helpful. I think something you said earlier that, you know, quantum is very interested in harnessing multidisciplinary insights, and that's not always been anthropologists and sociologists, but also psychologists and folks from the behavioral sciences. And so I was going to ask you next what specific advice you might have for, you know, qualitative researchers or in the qualitative space, you know, if you were to transition into this market research space, what are the skills that an agency like Quantum is looking for, or, you know, what are the sort of perspectives you should be cultivating if you, you know, wanted to dive into this exciting space of work?
So my advice would be really that if you are a social scientist of any kind, remember that a specialization is great, but learning other interdisciplinary disciplines that feed into your own specialization becomes extremely important. Because even when I was an anthropologist and I was doing a PhD, I was so interested in the psychology of behavior too. Self-learned, self-taught, I found time to read Jung, I found time to read Freud, I found time to read behavioral economics, I found time to read semiotics, you know, with Lacan. And so what I'm saying is that to be a true social scientist in the area of market research, you really need to have your own specialization where you're the master, but have an extremely eclectic desire to learn all the other disciplines that really impact. And so you could be historically oriented, you could be semiotically oriented, you could find politics important. All this plays a role. I mean, you've got to understand it's a holistic discipline, and therefore every discipline has that in qualitative research. So I really, for us, we welcome anybody who's both a specialist and a generalist, but has a wide fisheye lens about how you look at people and behavior. So that's really the most important thing that one is looking for. Open-minded, creative, intelligent, inquiring, curious, awestruck researchers.
So you're looking for curious, awestruck researchers. The word is out.
Thank you.
So as we, you know, wind down to a conclusion, I thought I'd ask you, looking ahead, 2020 and now 2021 too, we're almost halfway through the year. Crazy it is to think about. And these years have been unlike any other in our recent memory, for sure. So looking ahead, you know, what are the trends you're seeing in the market research space? What are the things you're excited about? Even the way, and I don't want to say just Indians, I'd wager globally, people are consuming things in more and more different ways, going to different corners of the internet to find themselves. You know, at Quantum, how are you grappling with these transformations? And what are you excited about?
We're very excited about a number of things. One is that we have slowly moved our entire business also in the space of design strategy. We are looking at designing solutions for all our clients and looking at much more outcome-oriented research projects where, you know, we provide deep insights on the one hand, but we also tell you how you can possibly build a strategy to come to a solution for that ask, the client ask. So that's one space. The other space that we really, as a company, are very deeply involved with is the space of purpose, brands and purpose. We believe that it's critical as we go forward for brands to have higher meaning in the lives of their consumer. And unless we can locate purpose around our brands, we will have a situation where brands will have no meaning for us. They'll become mere commodities. And only brands that really have a higher purpose are going to appeal to people, because there is a shift taking place. There is a crisis of meaning, and that crisis of meaning is being felt in the younger generations. And people are saying, what is it that I want from my life? What is it that I want from my consumption? What is it that I want from the brand that I use? And if I'm asking these quasi-spiritual questions, then I think marketing needs to take them seriously too. So what's my brand's purpose? What's the spiritual quotient that my brand should have? What kind of leadership should I be putting out there? What kind of responsibility should I be showing to the consumer as I produce products? Profit is not a bad thing, but if it's just mere profit, I think going forward, cultures are going to question that. So that's purpose is one space. Futuring is another space which we are really excited about. And as a company, we are also delving into it and we're looking at it. And these are the three spaces that we are currently excited about.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kaushik. This has been such a treat and a pleasure. I've been a great admirer of Quantum's work from far away for a while now. So this is absolutely a privilege. Thank you so much for joining this AnthroLife this morning.
Thank you, Madhuri. It's indeed a pleasure to be able to speak to you and to all the listeners who will be listening in to this. Thank you for inviting me. I'm deeply grateful.
Thanks again to Dr. Meena Kaushik for sharing her insights with us on everything from the evolution of fairness creams, the Indian sweet tooth, and the larger question of how we, anthropologists, sociologists, qualitative minded folks, add value in industries that have been traditionally dominated by numbers. Thanks, Adam. This was super great. And thanks to all the This AnthroLife listeners out there.
Thanks so much for spearheading today's episode, Madhuri. It was a ton of fun and super interesting. I really appreciate the way that Dr. Kaushik helped move between personal stories and narrative and larger issues happening both in India and market research, and just seeing how these pieces weave together so that we ourselves might think about new ways to bring insights that are more holistic, empowering, and impactful. As always, thanks for listening to This AnthroLife. Today's episode was produced by Madhuri Karak and myself. I always love hearing from you, so if you have any feedback on the episodes or what you want to hear more of or have an idea for a pitch yourself, shoot me a message at thisanthrolife@gmail.com or DM me on Twitter or Instagram. Always love to be in touch with folks and hear what's working for you and how we can bring you more and better content that connects this anthropology to every single part of our lives. Because after all, this is This AnthroLife. I'm Adam Gamwell, and we'll see you next time.